Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is podcast time. John is singing Judas Priest, Breaking the Law.
Breaking the law, we're breaking the law.
And he's getting in touch with his inner Saxon if you are a heavy metaler.
I got my letter strides on.
John just missed a gig that Eliza was on, which was Saxon and Judas Priest, John.
Fantastic.
And do you know the funny, we're going to talk about Protestants today, right? And
okay.
One thing that always struck me, we're going to talk about the power and pragmatism of Protestants and Protestantism.
Right.
This is our...
heavy metal.
Not heavy metal. No, but if you go to the north, and you know the northern brethren, what you realise, there are many things. So you know when you go in the north and you think, oh, Catholics and Protestants are really different.
Yeah.
What bonds the two tribes in the north is a love of motorbikes and heavy metal. I swear to God, you can get into conversation about heavy metal in the north. The more obscure the metal, the more northern it is. And I have spent the last week in two citadels of Protestantism, John. Geneva in Switzerland and East Belfast, where I was last night, giving a speech, not so much in East Belfast, but in Hollywood, in the Culloden Hotel. The Culloden Hotel, John.
Go on.
Van Morrison has a residency there. Every Sunday.
Sunday?
Van Morrison plays every Sunday in the Culloden Hotel. He does a series like 5 or 6 weeks.
Does he?
Every Sunday. Right.
Why?
Because that's what he does. Sunday afternoon, he gets up and plays.
Sunday afternoon, he gets up and plays.
In the Culloden Hotel. Yeah.
In bed by six.
In bed by six, like ourselves. In Cultraw in County Down. And
That's great.
I have a fascinating podcast for you, John. I have a fascinating series of observations which are going to link Leo Varadkar to John Calvin, to St. Peter's Church in Geneva,
right,
to East Belfast, to Irish unification, to fiscal federalism, to devolved government, and to direct democracy.
Right.
There now, you go.
There's a spider's web.
There's a spider's web of connections. But I was thinking this last night as I was...
Just before you start there, I just want to point out that, you know, just back to heavy metal.
Of course we're going back to heavy metal.
The one English band that never toured Ireland, that were one of the biggest bands in the world.
Led Zeppelin.
Iron Maiden.
They never came
to Ireland because of the North.
Really?
And I know that because Bruce Dickinson, who was the lead singer,
who's also a pilot.
Yes. Yeah. And a radio DJ. He did come to Ireland a few years ago and he did a storytelling show in the National Stadium.
Yeah.
And I went to that and it was fascinating. And there was questions from the crowd going, hey, Bruce, why didn't you ever come to Ireland? You have a massive following here. And that's the reason he gave.
Objecting to...
He kind of fudged the answer. But essentially, that's what he was saying. They were a little bit scared and they were a little bit anti the IRA and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other band who only came to Ireland once, band that you and I like, The Jam.
Yeah, they played about 100 yards down the road.
The Top Hat.
Yeah.
And then all through the 80s, they never came to Ireland. And it was never established, but a lot of people suggested because exactly of the North as well and the IRA. And they never toured Ireland.
Actually, there is one other story there.
John, you have to give it to me.
About The Jam. Our very good friend, Dubbo. was the biggest Jam fan
ever.
And he moved over to Boston years ago after school as an electrician, and he worked there for years. And Paul Weller was playing a solo gig in some local place there. And it was fantastic. And he went to see, bought the tickets, went, brought the missus down, the whole lot, and went to see.
In Boston.
Loved the gig. Fantastic. And Paul Weller was having a beer afterwards up at the bar. So Dubbo went up, say, hey, how's it going here? Blah, 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 blah. The in a scrap.
Did a scrap?
No, I didn't know what it was about.
They just didn't get on at all.
He hasn't played them since.
That's poor old John Dargan. Shout out to John Dargan, a.k.a. Double Dargan. So the other thing about Paul Weller, he was a vegetarian for years. And somebody asked him, why did you stop being a vegetarian? He just said, I was sick of being hungry.
That's fair enough.
But I was trying to explain last night at this talk I was given the difference between Southerners and Northerners. And I remember well being a best man at a Northern wedding of our friend Mr. Murphy.
Yes.
And Andrea. And I'm the best man, and it's in a Presbyterian church called Clonlig Presbyterian Church, just outside Bangor. Little small place of worship.
Yeah.
And so I rock up after the night before, which was heavy because we'd all just arrived up in Hollywood. And the wedding's at, let's say, 3 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, I come up with Murphy and we are met by the minister, the Presbyterian minister.
Right.
But he's no ordinary minister. He is a fellow called John Dunlop, and he is the moderator of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. So he's the capo, the tutti capi of Presbyterians.
Enter to the Dunlops of the...
Could well be, because it's a big Nordy name, right? Yeah. Big Nordy name. And he asks Murphy about the Bible. Murphy's looking at him going, nul point, having a rashers. So the wedding's at 3 o'clock. And of course, like all weddings, there's each side of the church, one for the groom and one for the bride, typically. But 10 to 3, the Nordy side all arrive in with their little bonnets, Presbyterians, Plymouth Brethren, the whole thing, on time. At 5 to 3, the moderator of the Presbyterian church says to me, where are your people?
Yeah.
Your side? And I said, I don't know, but I'll find them. And this is before mobile phones, mid-90s.
So
the rumour goes around that they were all in the Cultraw Inn, doing the classic Southern ritual of the few pints before the wedding.
We'll just have one more.
Just one more.
Quick one.
Exactly. Nordies had never, ever seen it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, how do I get them out? The Cultraw Inn is about 4 or 5 miles from the church. At about 3 minutes to 3, I am in the red Vauxhall Astra of the Presbyterian moderator. And he's in the car of his, whoring down to the bar to get them out of the pub.
Hot word.
And nobody ever says, oh, it's only 3 o'clock. It'll be grand. And then I just realized, you know, these are cultural differences that are so deep. Now, eventually we all did hurtle into the place and the wedding went all fine and all that sort of thing. But it was just that idea that the Nordies are on time. They're sober. They're getting down to the business of the wedding. And the Mexicans, as they call us, those fellas from south of the border, are just on the lash completely. That's my thing. But I was thinking of this, John, when I was in Geneva this week doing an event, right? And I was walking around Geneva, the old city of Geneva. And the old city of Geneva has this amazing...
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
It's really beautiful. Never been there before. It's really, really beautiful.
What really strikes me about Geneva is its cleanliness. It's super, super clean.
Prods are very clean.
Yeah.
Very, very clean, right? So I'm up in the Cathedral of St. Peter's, which is the citadel of John Calvin, of Calvinism.
Yeah.
And it is a Catholic cathedral that was built in the early, early years of the 15th century. So it's very Gothic, right? Except it was deconsecrated and reconsecrated a Calvinist cathedral after the Reformation.
Okay.
So you go into it, and what is amazing is you go into something that looks and feels like it's going to be a massively opulent, over-the-top cathedral, and there's nothing inside it. It's huge. There's no plaques. There's no Stations of the Cross. There's no pictures of saints. There's no candles. There's no ornamentation at all, and it really strikes you.
Yeah.
It's unbelievably austere. And then just at the front, where there should be a massive altar with bells and whistles and
a bit of gold and
loads of gold and swinging handbags and all sorts of stuff. There is what looks like a little kitchen table with just the Bible on it.
Right.
And you're struck by the austerity, by the grimness of it, right?
Mm.
And then I was fascinated. I went to, adjacent to this is the Museum de la Réforme, the Musée de la Réforme. And it's basically the Reformation Museum. And it's the history of Swiss and French Protestantism. So if you think about what they were all about, in the early 16th century, Zwingli, Ulrich Zwingli in Switzerland and Martin Luther in Germany come out against the Catholic Church. And they say, basically, selling indulgences, which was one of the greatest scam of all.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It was
absolutely
a great scam.
That was the Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, that was
it?
The of greatest course. Ponzi scheme, yeah. Right? So they said, look, this is amoral. And they came out and they said, look, we don't need the church. We don't need the Vatican. We don't need the bishops. Don't need this hierarchy. We don't need these layers and layers of administration. We want to create this direct link between the people and God through the Bible.
Yeah.
So that everybody can have a direct link with God.
Mm.
And the way you do is you learn the Bible. So the Bible became everything for them. And of course, literacy was a big part because you had to learn the Bible. Whereas in the Catholic religion, the priests learned the Bible and they said to everyone, you don't have to be literate. Don't worry, we'll look after this gig for you. I says the Americans.
That was Charlemagne's
exactly.
gig. Yeah.
That's what the Americans say, I got this, right? Yeah.
They're allowed to say, hold my beer.
Yeah, exactly, hold my beer. But the prods, when you go to these museums, you realize that this was a revolutionary movement about liberating people, right? And particularly liberating women. There were loads and loads of female theologists. And one of the most extraordinary things I saw in the museum, it really struck me, was a tiny, tiny Bible, like a miniature Bible. It was so miniature, if you can imagine this, that the Huguenot women could hide it in their trussed-up hair, right? Imagine
right,
this,
okay.
Right?
Wow.
Because owning the Bible was a criminal offense for the Catholics, because only the church could own the Bible.
Yeah.
And owning the Bible was a sign of liberation for the Calvinists. So they had to hide the Bibles. And if they were caught with the Bible, right, you were tortured.
Wow.
So, but yet they were so radical. And the whole idea was this flat relationship between you and God.
Yeah.
And this flat relationship with no need for hierarchy. And it gave this sort of empowering of the citizen and creating what they would call an engaged citizen, an engaged member of the brethren. And this particular museum was absolutely fascinating. And then I was thinking to myself, what about the legacy of that, right? Because now, like, Switzerland is like all most secular countries, that Calvinism is on the wane. I think there's only 20 or 25% people still subscribe actively to the religion, right? Mm. But you think, what is the legacy of that innately democratic and very pragmatic way of looking at the world? It's like in music, it's a stripped back gig.
Yeah.
So you talk about your Iron Maiden, right?
Unplugged.
You imagine Iron Maiden unplugged. Well, Protestantism is basically Iron Maiden unplugged, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Whereas Iron Maiden is full of fuck off Catholicism.
Yeah.
With bells and whistles and smoke.
Wasn't it Bono who said Catholicism was the glam rock of Christianity?
Yeah, but he's right. He's right. So imagine Protestantism is stripped back heavy metal, right? And what it is a very, very pure way of looking at the world. This is the original idea.
Yeah.
It's morphed and you know, this is Ireland, so we all know
our roots.
Yeah, we all know about sectarianism here, right? But as a general idea, and then I was thinking to myself, what has it done for Switzerland? What's the deep legacy of it? And then if you look at the way the Swiss run their country, they run their country in a very flat structure. It's called devolved government, devolved democracy, direct democracy, fiscal federalism. But the basic idea in Switzerland is that anything that can be done at the local level should not be done at the national level, right? That's their idea. Subsidiarity all the time. And I believe that comes from this deep Protestant worldview where you should be self-sufficient, you should look after your own little patch, you don't need to be dependent on
So Swiss democracy is direct democracy, but it's a very, it's democracy, but totally
but not
different.
As we know it.
But not as we know
Captain
it.
As Captain Kirk would say, exactly. It's democracy, Jim, but not as we know it, right?
So explain that then. What's the big difference?
The reason I want to explain this is the following. We have had the resignation of Leo Varadkar here in Ireland. All the news is about, why did he do it? Why did he do it now? La, 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 right?
Yeah.
I'm much more interested in the system he sat on top of. The system of governments that we have here in Ireland, where we cannot build things, we cannot make things, where we go over budget, etc. One of the reasons I believe this is that the link between the local and the national is broken, right?
Yeah.
That far too many things that can be done at a local level are assumed up to the national level, a bit like in Catholicism, you know, where the people couldn't make a decision. You had to go to the priest, and the priest would go to the archbishop, and the archbishop would go to the Vatican, right?
Yeah.
So that's the structure that I'm thinking about, right? So in the Swiss case, and the reason this is important is we have to change our country, and we have to change the way we run this country
right.
in the future, right? And that comes back to our Protestant friends in the north in a second, right?
Okay.
At some stage, there will be some type of reunification here. So if you look at the intersection of economics, politics, demography in this country,
yeah,
the system is broken. So we definitely have to change this system, even if we didn't have the prospect of unity or reunification coming down the track.
Okay.
So what can we learn from the Swiss? That's what I'm saying, right? What can we learn from the Swiss? The Swiss have these three layers of government. One is the Confederation, which is the national parliament.
Right.
One is the canton, which is, like, imagine a provincial parliament. So if you were to do it Ulster, Leinster, Munster,
okay.
canton, just think of it in that way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's in a mass, like counties, but bigger versions of counties.
Mm.
And then the third layer is the commune, which would be like our county councils or our wards here, right? So basically what they've done is they've inverted politics. So the smaller, the more local you are, the more power you have. Or to put it another way, people's everyday lives are far more likely to be driven by local politicians and by local decisions than they are by national, right?
Right.
Okay.
That's a good thing, though.
It's a very, very good thing. It's a very, very good thing because it gives the local politicians skin in the game, and it makes sure that local politicians and local infrastructure is paid locally, and it gives people a proximity to power. Now, the way they do this is the following. Each commune, so the very, very local level,
yeah.
is responsible for education, right? Okay. And it can raise taxes.
Okay.
To pay for that.
Okay.
Right? Education, roads, the sort of thing that local governments should be doing. Planning, for example, right?
Right.
Then at the cantonal level, they are responsible for the health service. They are responsible for other various taxations. And then at the confederation level, they're responsible for defense, foreign affairs, etc.
Okay.
But amazingly, the national government's ability to raise taxes has to be made legitimate by local government, and that can only be made legitimate by local referenda. So the big government doesn't have the ability to spend. It's capped. Its spending is capped, and its ability to raise taxes is capped.
So how are economic policies then devised?
So big economic policies. So like you think defense, foreign affairs, for example, customs, how the Swiss deal with the rest of the world,
yeah.
they're all done at the national
what
level.
What about the kind of interest rates? And
interest rates are done by the Bank of Switzerland, and the Bank of Switzerland, Swiss National Bank, is under the Swiss government.
Right.
So at the very, very top, those big decisions are taken, but on an extremely judicious and practical level where they can't get bloated.
Right.
Like I was just looking before Varadkar resigned, the Irish Times had a list of the amount of advisors there are for our politicians.
Right.
Hundreds. Hundreds of people advising them to do the job that civil servants are paid to do. Right?
If you think about it, right?
So I was thinking...
They're all probably advising each other.
Yeah. Having a chat.
One cancelling out the other one.
Yeah. So we go back to the Swiss idea, right? So it means that you have executive powers at a local level with tax-raising potency.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's like having a local mayor.
Exactly, directly elected mayor with tax-raising competence. Now, what that means is that that person or those people have skin in the game. The buck stops with them.
Yeah.
One of the dilemmas in Ireland is that when you look at the children's hospital, when you look at the metro, when you look at anything, the buck stops with nobody.
Yeah.
So nobody can stick their hand up and say, it's my fault. Whereas in Switzerland, because they've inverted power, which means that the local has more power than the cantonal,
yeah.
And the cantonal has more power than the confederate. It means the local has more power than the regional, and the regional has more power than the national.
So
you're flipping the whole thing on its head.
So the local Swiss communities, they're voting weekly, monthly?
They're having referenda all the time on things.
Wow. You know? That must be kind of exhausting as well.
But it's
engaging, I suppose.
But this is the whole idea, right? So we, for example, have a system of democracy that you might call spectator democracy. so that every 4 years, right? So we're going to have an election very soon, right?
Yeah.
We all sit around and there's an election campaign for 6 weeks and everyone's talking about the issues. And then we go into the ballot box and we give the thumbs up, the thumbs down to Tweedledum or Tweedledee, right? Yes. That fella or the other fella, that one or the other one, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That once we've done that, we kind of pack up our democratic tent and we sit back and we spectate.
Yes. Right? Yeah, yeah.
And we kind of basically sit, it reminds me of people in the Colosseum. So we say, okay, now we've given you the thumbs up and thumbs down. Now, where are the gladiators? Come on, you guys go and have a scrap. Yeah, and we go, ooh, for them. And we sit as spectators and we kind of point fingers.
More
we,
wine, more bread.
Yeah, more wine, more bread, more circuses for my man. Exactly, more lions for that Christian, right? But what we do is we spectate in democracy as opposed to become engaged with the democracy.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
In the Swiss case, democracy is ever present. You're constantly being mandated. So rather than be a disgruntled observer, which we become, you become a mandated player, which they become. Right.
So are you saying that this is possibly derived from religion and the flavor of religion?
Yes.
So Catholicism allows us to kind of point the finger at somebody else and go, they're responsible for it and not me.
Exactly. So we absolve ourselves of responsibility.
Right.
Because we have engaged once every 4 years in democracy.
Yeah, we've done our bit.
We've done our bit. And the great thing about Catholicism and a really fundamental, we have the best sacrament ever.
Yeah.
Confession. Sorry, I didn't mean it.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Like, 10 Hail Marys.
10 Hail Marys, two Our Fathers, and away you go, right? Yeah. So imagine that structure, right? The whole structure of Catholicism is to make sure that everybody's in control and nobody's in control.
Yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, right? And if you replicate that or superimpose that onto a political system, you have our political system, right?
Yeah.
The Swiss, on the other hand, have again almost photocopied their Protestant engaged citizen, engaged brethren, engaged disciple idea with the relationship with the God and through the Bible and responsibility onto the way they run their country, right? And so they don't trust the Vatican. They don't, when I say the Vatican, they don't trust the political equivalent of the Vatican, which is the Dáil.
Yes.
They just don't trust them.
Yeah, yeah,
they don't trust the political equivalent of the archbishops and the clerisy, right? Which are the national politicians.
Yeah, yeah.
They trust the people they know who live beside them, who they can stop in the street and say, hey, you, you're supposed to be doing this. You're not doing it.
Yeah.
What we do is we elect a chieftain. And that chieftain, let's say you take the Healy Rays being a good example, right? That chieftain...
Are they a good example, though?
But in this context, they are, right? That chieftain goes up to Dublin and lobbies for money.
Yeah.
Right? Gets the money from central government, right? Comes back to Kerry with the bag of swag and says, I'm the dog's bollocks now.
Yeah.
Right? And then I will determine who gets everything. And so those chieftains become ultra-powerful legates. You know, in the old Roman system, the delegates. They become legates to Rome. And then they come back with a bag of swag. But what it means is there's no connection between the national and the local when it comes to actually who's to blame. And so it means that if things go wrong, the local politicians can blame those lads up in Dublin.
Yes.
Which they do all the time.
Yeah, yeah,
those
fellas
inside the Dáil, right?
Yeah.
So basically what they can do is rather than take responsibility, they can blame the government in Dublin, which is exactly what the Catholics were doing years ago. Rather than take responsibility, the Pope, he's a bad Pope this time.
Yeah.
Wait till we get a good Pope.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Okay, that sounds great. But is it easier to run a system like that or have a system like that when there's very little inequality?
You're absolutely right. So what you have in Switzerland, I mean, there are problems in Switzerland.
Yeah.
But it is, on most metrics, one of the most successful countries in the world, right? There are inequality is usually with immigrants, not with Swiss. So the immigrants are much poorer than the Swiss, etc. So there are problems.
Yeah.
It's not an ideal situation. But what it is, it's a very interesting model of how to run a democracy in a globalized world, right? A democracy that functions in a globalized world. And this idea of subsidiarity and devolved power gives a certain amount of answerability to the system. And if you look at Swiss, it seems to work.
Yeah.
So it seems, John, that the Swiss system offers far more solutions to their problems than our system because it involves more people. And it, in a way, makes everybody take a little bit of responsibility. And that, I suppose, when you're thinking of how the countries run in a globalized world with immigration, with taxes, with money, with multinationals, etc. That would seem to me to be, you know, a Calvinistic light bulb going off in our heads, John.
And to add to that, a possible reunification in this country in a few years' time.
Yeah.
So is that going to be a good opportunity to kind of reassess our system here and perhaps...
You're absolutely right, John. I think the prospect of reunification, which is a demographic imperative, right?
Yeah.
It will become, right?
Yeah.
We just have to wait for it. It's going to come, right? Gives Ireland the opportunity to completely change the Republic. Remember we spoke about this, the Second Republic? That yeah. We need a Second Republic here. Like we're voting on... Think about what we did last week. We're voting on a constitution was constructed by De Valera and John Charles McQuaid.
Yes.
Nearly 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Get rid of it. So if we're going to have a Second Republic, coincident with or ahead of reunification, we should look at this Swiss model and think, can we learn from them?
Okay, let's examine that a little bit more after a bit of this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, Mike, let's take this Calvinist
yes.
direct democracy model of governance in Switzerland. And how can we apply that to here? Well,
I think there's two levels. I think right now, the system upon which Leo Varadkar sat at the top of, that system is completely broken in terms of it doesn't do what it says in the tin, which is run the country in a way that we can build houses in the right place.
Yeah.
At the right price for the right people. We can't build metros. We can't build schools. We can't build anything where the state is involved in big projects falls down completely. And it is because of a lack of accountability. Nobody is to blame. That there's nobody sticking their hand up and saying, it's my problem.
Yeah.
So I think we can use, firstly, we can examine the Swiss direct democracy idea and fiscal federalism and devolved combination of economics and politics, just for that. But secondly, you mentioned Northern Ireland, where I was there the other day,
yeah.
right? If we are to contemplate a reasonably peaceful integration of 800,000 unionists, we need to come up with a system of government which gives them more autonomy than yeah. they have. Now, fascinatingly, for this context, the Swiss came up with their confederation in the 19th century. And one of the major reasons they did come up with, you know, the cantons and the communes and the confederacy and all that,
yeah.
is that Switzerland is a country of four main languages. So it's got German, French, Italian, and Romansh, which is an ancient... Remember we talk about Ladino,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
Ancient
yeah.
language,
yeah.
right? It has...
How many people speak that?
Very few, about 400,000 or 500,000.
But that's still a lot. Considerable,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
Switzerland, just so that you know, has a population of just under 9 million.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah. it's about three quarters the size of Ireland.
Yeah.
Thereabouts.
And it's about three quarters the size of Ireland. its major population are German-speaking.
Mm.
They're the majority, about 60%.
Yeah.
Then you've got about 30% French speakers, maybe 25% French speakers, 10% Italians, and a few of these Romansh people, right?
Okay, okay.
But they all default to any language. They're multilingual, and that's part of the whole idea.
Yeah.
But their major reason for doing this form of government, and this is the fascinating thing for us and the unionists, it was to make sure that decisions taken by the French Calvinists about their own lives were largely going to be dictated by French Calvinists. And decisions taken by German Catholics in their own lives were largely going to be dictated by German Catholics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you wouldn't get a situation where ethnically a German Catholic parliament was dictating to a French Calvinist community. So they thought, how do we do this? So what we do then is we invert everything. So we make sure that we sort of avoid those risks of that happening. And that, in a way, takes out a lot of the rawness of who's ruling who in an ethnically divided society and a religiously divided society. Now, we have, or we will have, a religiously divided society, right?
Yeah.
We will have
yeah.
800,000 Northern Protestants who are at best uneasy, at worst completely opposed to reunification, right? But the demography is such that they will end up being a majority in only two counties of the 32 counties of Ireland, in Antrim and County Down.
Yeah.
And half of County Down will be completely nationalist and the other half will be unionist. So we've got to think, how do you figure this out? How do you make sure that they can come into an Ireland where they feel that they're not being swamped and are beaten and are bullied, right?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And there's lots of people listening to the podcast might say, well, screw them. Right,
yeah.
But on the basis you can't design.
I know you can't
design government. Can screw them, right?
Yeah, you know, no. I mean, it's looking at long term.
Long term, and how does the whole thing work?
The chip off the shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you could do. So, I mean, marry one of them. You know, that's a very extreme example of integration, right? But I mean, so, but so you think, okay, well, look at the Swiss did. If you did direct democracy in a post-reunification Ireland, it means the people in Antrim and Carrickfergus and Ballymena and all those people would largely get on with their own business.
Yeah.
They would send delegates to the national parliament to decide, you know, VAT rates vis-a-vis the rest of the world, customs unions, defence, foreign policy, whatever. But the bread and butter of governments would be really their own. And what that would do is it would take away the sort of occupation feeling that they might have, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is, and I've said it to my separated brethren up north a lot, is that the union is the least Protestant thing they could ever do. So if you imagine that Calvinism is all about self-sufficient.
Yeah.
So Calvinism is all about you spend what you have, you don't beg off other people.
Yeah.
You don't prostrate yourself to other people and say, give us money,
yeah.
right? That is the least Protestant thing they've done. The act of union, the union in Northern Ireland has turned Northern Irish Calvinists into beggars because they can't raise their own money. So they're constantly going to London to beg from English people.
Yeah.
So they've turned into supplicants, where the whole idea of Protestantism was to become a individual, sovereign, engaged citizen looking after your moral welfare, your financial welfare, etc. Right? That was Protestantism all about. What the union has turned them into is a concubine race.
How did this go down when you said this to them?
This is, you've got to do it with a sense of humour, with a pint, with a little glass of Bushmills, you know. But I'm talking philosophically.
Yeah.
So what it's done, and ironically, it's turned the Catholics in the North into Protestants, because the Catholics in the North were told, you're not part of the country, you're not one of us. So what did the Catholics do over the last 40 years? Said, okay, let's do it ourselves.
Yeah.
Let's do it through the GAA. Let's do it through education. So the Catholics in the North behave like Calvinists, and the Calvinists in the North behave like pre-Reformation Catholics, right?
Yeah.
It's a weird situation. The whole thing has been turned on its head. And so the Catholics in the North are the ones who've got the get up and go, the self-improvement people.
Yeah.
So you look at business in the North, it's all Catholic run.
So
the Protestants have become the lax, don't worry, we'll devolve all the big decisions to Westminster. So Westminster has become the Vatican, right? They've created an entire Catholic, pre-Reformation Catholic structure. Basically, Rishi Sunak is the Pope for these prods, okay? Even though he's Hindu, right? Okay.
He's getting really complicated.
No, but look, think about it. Whereas on the other hand, the Northern Catholics who were left on their own, because we didn't look after them.
Yeah.
The Protestant didn't look after them. They have become Protestant. And they think like Protestants. And they actually think like Calvinists. And we've got to deal with that, that what we're dealing with are ideas, notions, flags and emblems that suggest something, but reality signifies something else. And this, I think, and so the opportunity is to change the whole country.
So, but you're saying, so the opportunity might arise at a point of reunification, but how likely is it?
Well,
that we, I mean, that's, it's such a fundamental change. I like it, I have to say. Because the other thing as well, what's happened in the last few weeks with Varadkar going, is that there's been what? So far, there's been 11 or so TDs leaving the Fine Gael party. So politicians don't want to be politicians anymore.
Because they can't work the system.
Yeah.
Because the system is completely dysfunctional.
But it might bring in new fresh blood, people thinking on, not on a big geopolitical national level, but on a local level, and getting stuff done.
This is my point, is that the future for Ireland is local.
Mm.
The future is not some supranational notions. It's local, local, local. And demography is changing. People's political persuasion is changing. But much more importantly, the system is broken. You cannot run a country that cannot build houses for its people. These are fundamental issues. You cannot run a country that cannot build hospitals for its people, right? There's no point us being rich if we can't do this, right? This is the crazy thing.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The whole idea was your country gets rich, you have resources, you throw off money, you spend the money, you build good stuff, and it's a virtuous signal, right?
Yeah.
We have got rich, but we feel poorer.
Yeah.
Because side by side with a wealthy private sector is a public realm that is atrophying and degrading. And it's degrading because nobody's taking responsibility for it. And nobody's taking responsibility for it because the system that we have built, that we have evolved into, is a system where there's no connection between local issues and national politics. And the only connection is through this system of legates. I come back to the Roman legates, right? Who are basically middlemen between the tax authority and local needs, right? Whereas if you invert all that and you say, okay, we're in Galway and we need something, let's just do it locally. And if there is, for example, a shortfall, where you think, because Galway hasn't got the resources to build what it wants to be, there's a shortfall. Well, then we figure out a way of equalizing that. But the basic impetus for change has to come from the local. And when I was walking around, John, the Calvin Museum the other day, these are the bizarre things that strike me. And I was actually looking at a exhibition of Rembrandt and the Bible, right? Yeah. So Rembrandt, of course, was a Calvinist and he was very into the Bible. And he was, the other branch of Calvinism was in Holland. So you had the Swiss and the Dutch. And I was thinking, you know, this is all very interesting and the etchings are fine and all that sort of stuff. But the real message is a way of looking at the world. And what has happened in our country is the original Calvinists, right, have turned into, in effect, pre-Reformation Catholics. The original Catholics have returned into Calvinists. The Union is the Vatican. And interestingly, the people who are most against the Union aren't the reforming Calvinists, but are actually the progressive Catholics in the North. We in the South, who share the same island with them, should use this shock to the system, because it's going to be a massive shock, to think, okay, is our system the best one? Is it fit for purpose? And if it's not, we should have a reformation mindset. And what a reformation mindset is basically, like Luther, to go and put your 96 things on the thing and say, it's not working, lads. Let's do something else. So that's the prize. You don't necessarily have to be in the red Vauxhall Astra of the moderator of the Presbyterian Church to conclude this, but it does help. Talk to you Thursday. Just before we go, John, big week. Lucy's debut EP, Third Second Chance, out now. We'll be right back.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.